An influential group of big technology corporations, commonly referred to as Big Tech, has concentrated vast economic power with the collusion of states, which has resulted in expanded surveillance, spiraling disinformation, and weakened workers' rights. TNI's 11th flagship State of Power report exposes the actors, the strategies, and the implications of this digital power grab, and shares ideas on how movements might bring technology back under popular control. Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I'm your host, Sean Macheza. Our guest on the podcast today, Cory Doctorow, is a prolific writer and a brilliant science fiction novelist, journalist, and technology activist. He's a special consultant to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a nonprofit civil liberties group that defends freedom in technology, law, policy, standards, and treaties. His most recent book is Chokepoint Capitalism, co-authored with Rebecca Giblin, a powerful expose of how tech monopolies have stifled creative labor markets and how movements might fight back. In the following conversation, Nick Buxton and I chatted to Cory in the wake of floods in his hometown of Burbank, California. Nick leads the Knowledge Hub at TNI and is the editor of the State of Power report. He began by asking the big open question that is at the heart of this year's report: who has digital power today?
That is an excellent question, and I think that to understand or to answer it well, we need to distinguish between different kinds of digital power, like latent digital power, active digital power, and so on. So, you know, as Tom Eastman, who's a software developer in New Zealand, has observed, the web has devolved into five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four. And it's definitely the case that a small number of extremely powerful firms have what the European regulators call gatekeeper power. The right to decide who can speak, who can reach one another, how it works. This is a marked departure from the early ethos that birthed these firms, which was characterized by something that was then called the end-to-end principle, the idea that the internet would be a new kind of network where anyone who wanted to speak to anyone could do so without any third party intervening. We now have any number of choke points in which adjacent activities, for example, like fundraising, can be controlled by one of a very small number of firms. And it's important to note that the reason those firms were allowed to grow as large as they have, the reason that antitrust regulators, competition regulators turned such a blind eye as they accumulated that power, is because states view those firms as potential deputies for their own exercises of power. You know, it seems unlikely, for example, that the NSA could have gotten regulatory authority or managed to sneak around and convinced us all to carry beacons that broadcast our location, not just in the U.S., but all over the world, by allowing firms to do that, by failing to step in and demand regulation. The U.S. government has accomplished a future in which the NSA doesn't need to wiretap us all. It can just ask Facebook or Google or Apple for information that would be otherwise unreachable for it. And so this really needs to be understood as a public-private partnership. This is something that I think is poorly understood by some critics of technology in the tech sector. You know, when I go to Silicon Valley and give a talk, I will often hear from tech workers, well, you know, Google just wants my information so they can show me better ads. But NSA is and the Pentagon are filled with losers who couldn't get a job at a tech company, who are kind of, you know, evil sadists who will abuse that information in a million ways. Meanwhile, when you go to the Beltway and you speak to an audience of people who are sort of government and government adjacent, you'll hear them say things like, well, you know, Uncle Sam requires me to give them every conceivable piece of information about me in order to get and maintain my status to work with classified documents. And I trust them to know what I'm doing. But those, you know, mercenaries down at Google and Facebook, they'd sell their mother for a nickel. I wouldn't trust them with my information if I didn't have to. And both parties are missing the fact that neither one could be doing the kind of data collection that they do without the other one, and that both of them depend on each other. So to that first approximation, you know, tech companies and the governments that they're beholden to have an enormous amount of digital power. But there are some second order implications here. You know, to understand whether governments can suborn a tech firm, we need to look at geopolitics and regulation. So in the mid 2000s, early 2010s, we saw tech firms moving into established local offices in countries where the rule of law was very weak. I think there was a kind of a watershed with Google moving into and then out of China. And then we saw lots of firms setting up shop in Russia after their accession to the World Trade Organization agreements. We saw Twitter setting up an office in Turkey. And all of this was important because it put people in harm's way. So it gave the national governments of these countries the power to literally lay hands on important people within that corporate structure, and therefore to coerce cooperation from those firms in a way that would be much harder if, say, you know, Erdogan wanted to shake his saber at Google in down in Mountain View, California. If the nearest Google executive was an ocean and a continent away, Google would have a very different calculus about its participation in Turkish surveillance than they do when there are people that they care about who could be physically rounded up and chucked in prison. And, you know, similarly, there's a technical story, the proliferation of great firewalls, first in China, and then as a turnkey matter elsewhere, as Chinese and Western companies sell to governments with very little of their own technical capacity, turnkey solutions to establish their own national firewalls, that allow them to say to companies, unless you put someone in this country, and unless you store your data in this country, we will block you at the nation's border. And they cite the European Union, and they cite data localization rules from the EU that says that US firms operating in the European Union can't move Europeans' data to the United States where the NSA can get at it. This is a perfectly reasonable regulation for the EU to have made. But depending on the nature of the government that's making a comparable order, it may be that they have even less respect for privacy than the NSA, or they are even more apt to weaponize data of the their own citizens than the USA. I'm thinking, for example, of how the Ethiopian state has used turnkey mass surveillance tools from Western firms to round up, arrest, torture, and murder, in some cases, opposition figures that are part of a legitimate democratic opposition. And so for those people, I think arguably they would be better off if their data were sent to the United States and merely plundered by the NSA. Not that either of those things is a good outcome, but to understand how it is that that data is within reach of Ethiopian authorities, you have to understand the interplay of data localization, national firewall technology, and the imperative of firms to establish sales offices in country all over the world in order to maximize their profits. So all of that is kind of the bad news, but there is good news. And the good news is that digital technology is foundationally different from other kinds of technology. I know that technological exceptionalism is in bad odor in this decade, and I'm not much of a technological exceptionalist, but there is one way in which I think digital technology is genuinely exceptional. In fact, it's really two ways. They're both aspects of the same facet, which is that digital technology is universal. There's really only one kind of computer we know how to build. It's the Turing Complete von Neumann machine. And formally, that is a computer that can run every program that we know how to write, which means that if there is a computer that is designed to surveil you, there is a program that can run on that computer that will frustrate that surveillance. That is very different from other kinds of technology that we have had in our world, because those programs can be infinitely reproduced at the click of a mouse and installed all over the world. Now, this means on the one hand that criminals are able to exploit technologies that we have in all kinds of terrible ways. You know, there is no such thing as a hospital computer that can only run the X-ray machine and not also run ransomware. But it means that what we used to call hacktivism, and what is increasingly just being called good industrial policy, as contemplated in things like the European Digital Markets Act, where new things are allowed to plug into existing things to give the users of those things more power, that has the potential to tip the balance, to create a system of asymmetric warfare in which the infrastructure of these large firms and the states that support them are suborned to support people who oppose them.
Yeah, thanks, Corey. You mentioned how states are sort of deputizing private corporations in what you call public-private cooperation. But could you go a little bit deeper, maybe just really break down how digitalization and artificial intelligence now have changed the way corporations and the state exercise power? How do they intersect?
Yeah, I think machine learning is best understood as an adjunct. So I'll talk about it without the machine learning piece and then maybe add a little machine learning in at the end there. Mm-hmm. So here's a very clear example. Google gathers your location data in a way that is plainly deceptive. So if you turn off location tracking in your Android device or in apps that are built using Google's API, its toolkit, or in your iOS device that's running a Google app like Google Maps, if you turn off location tracking, it will not stop tracking your location. There's at least 12 different places where you have to turn it off to actually stop the location tracking. And even then, it's not clear if they're really doing it. This is so bizarre and so over the top that in various regulatory investigations of Google, we have now seen memos retrieved from the company in which product managers, senior product managers for Google location services, complain that they can't figure out how to turn off location tracking. Now, in any kind of sane world, this would be a prohibited activity. You know, Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act gives the agency broad latitude to intervene to prevent unfair and deceptive practices. It's hard to defend the idea that if you click the don't track me button and you're still tracked, that practice is fair and non-deceptive. This is clearly the kind of thing the law prohibits. And yet here we are, right? This is not a revelation that Google tracks you even when they say they're not tracking you, even if you click the don't track me button. They have no basis to track you. It's really clear that this has been going on for a long time. It's not a surprise that it's happened. And yet governments have not taken action. We haven't seen legislation, nor have we seen regulation to impede this. Now, at the same time, we see the increasing use of Google location data in what are called either geofenced warrants or reverse warrants. And this is where a law enforcement agency goes to Google, sometimes with a warrant, but not always, and says, here is a box, this street by this street by this street by this street, and here's a time frame, you know, 1 p.m. till 4 p.m. Tell me everyone who was in that box during that time. It was used extensively against Black Lives Matter demonstrators and then against the January 6th rioters. And you can see here how the state has a perverse incentive not to prevent this deceptive, unfair conduct, this dangerous conduct, because of course, a company as big as Google is always gonna have insider threats, right? They're going to have individuals who work at Google who will take bribes from other people. You know, Twitter, for example, is well understood to have had Saudi operatives working within Twitter who infiltrated the company and then stole Saudi users' data and provided it to Saudi intelligence services so they could both surveil these activists, but then also take reprisals against them in the most violent and ghastly ways imaginable. And then finally, you know, any data you collect will eventually leak. And so there's all of this data sort of kicking around that could leak or be taken over by criminals or what have you. And you know, any kind of sound regulation would involve snuffing this conduct out, and yet it trundles on. And I think the only way to understand why it trundles on is that there are too many stakeholders within the U.S. government side who rely on this deceptive conduct continuing, who rely on the assembly of these very dangerous and deceptive databases to make their jobs easier, to figure out who was where when they want to figure out who was where. And not only do they fail to support efforts to rein in Google and other firms, they actually brief against it, both publicly and then behind the scenes. You'll often hear from congressional staffers or regulators that law enforcement agencies have come to them privately and told them not to continue on initiatives to regulate location tracking because it is so important to their law enforcement objectives or their national security objectives. So, you know, it's very hard As Upton Sinclair once observed, to get someone to understand something when their paycheck depends on them not understanding it. And it is very hard to get a government to snuff out some dangerous conduct when so many of its most important stakeholders benefit from it. Now, machine learning is a special instance of this. Machine learning, I don't like the term artificial intelligence. I don't even really like the term machine learning, but statistical inference lacks a certain je ne sais quoi. So we'll call it machine learning, but please let's not call it artificial intelligence. It is neither artificial nor is it intelligent. Machine learning allows for, I think best understood as allowing for automated judgment at a scale that human beings couldn't attain. So, if you want to identify everything that is face shaped in a crowd and then look through the database of all the faces that you know about and make guesses about those faces, under normal circumstances, the ability of a state to conduct that would be cabined off by how many people they had. The former East Germany had, 1 in 60 people working in some capacity for the intelligence services. They couldn't have come close to that scale of surveillance. But that brings up a couple of important problems. The first is that it might work, and the second is that it might not. So if it does work, it's an intelligence capacity beyond the dreams of any dictator in history. It's a kind of perfect knowledge. And if you think of there being a kind of equilibrium between a government's ability to capture and neutralize opposition figures and its necessity to prevent oppositions from gaining steam by governing well, then the easier it is for a government to prevent an opposition, the less it has to pay attention to governing well to stop that opposition from forming in the first place. So there's a kind of equilibrium between building hospitals and building prisons. And the cheaper it is to build prisons, the fewer hospitals, roads, and schools you need to build, and the less you have to govern well, and the more you can govern in the interests of powerful stakeholders. And so when it works, it's bad. And when it fails, it's bad. Because these things are definitionally operating at a scale that's too fast to have a human in the loop. If all you wanted to do was automate looking through a mugshot book for purse snatchers at the same rate and with the same accuracy that you used to do when it was the person who had their purse snatched and two police detectives in a room paging through a book, then there would be no reason to build this software. The point of this software is to do it so fast and so comprehensively that no human can ever check its work. And so if you have millions of judgments being made every moment at a scale that no human could ever hope to supervise, and if there's only a small amount of error, say it's 1%, well, 1% of a million is 10,000 hours errors a second. And so you would have 10,000 undetected errors a second in a million judgments every second. And so those are never going to be caught by a human in the loop. We essentially have a rheostat. We have a dial that we can turn towards faster or more careful. And ML is a way of turning it all the way to faster and all the way as far away as possible from more careful.
Thanks, Corey. I want to hone in a bit on the kind of state side of power, kind of coercive power. You've touched on it already, but I think for most people, the moment where people came really aware of the scale and the potential for state to kind of exercise unaccountable surveillance powers, of course, with the Snowden revelations. And I was wondering if you could say what has kind of unfolded since then. Have we seen basically it continue on in the same pattern? Has there been changes? What's been the kind of dynamics you've noticed in terms of kind of state surveillance, and particularly the kind of unaccountable and often untransparent and undemocratic exercises of state power, not just in the US, but internationally?
I mean, sadly, it hasn't been great. I do think that we have an increased sense that surveillance is taking place. It's not as controversial to say that we are under mass surveillance, that our digital devices are being suborned by the state. It has created the space for firms and for nonprofits to create and maintain surveillance-resistant technologies. I mean, I think you can look at the rise of the use of things like Signal, as well as the integration by large firms like Facebook of anti-surveillance technology in WhatsApp as being directly related to this. So there is some sense in which people are cognizant of it. And I think in industry, there is an increased sense that the mechanism whereby this mass surveillance was undertaken was bad for industry, because the core mechanism for doing mass surveillance is to research in great detail how commonly used technologies work for people who work for government surveillance agencies, to devote a lot of energy to figuring out how these things work and to identifying defects in their programming, which are inevitable. And then rather than reporting those defects back up to the manufacturer so they can be mitigated before someone else discovers them and exploits them, these defects are hoarded, and then they're used to attack adversaries of the agency that discovered them. So the NSA discovers some bug in Windows, and rather than telling Microsoft about it, they use it to hack people they think are terrorists, or people they think are spies, or people they think are just adverse to U.S. national interests. And the problem with that is that these defects do get independently rediscovered, that the name of the doctrine under which these defects are discovered and weaponized is NOBUS, which stands for no one but us, as in no one but us is smart enough to have discovered this mistake that Microsoft made, so we don't have to tell Microsoft about it because no one is ever going to rediscover it. And there were a couple of really important leaks of these cyber weapons from WikiLeaks, the Vault 7, the Vault 8 leaks. And because we got to see a kind of full tranche of cyber weapons from these agencies, we were able to compare the vulnerabilities that they were exploiting to the vulnerabilities that were being exploited by criminals and foreign governments. And what we discovered is that there's about a 1 in 5 chance per year that any given defect will be independently rediscovered and operationalized by either a criminal or a government, which means that the US government exposed its stakeholders, firms and individuals, to a gigantic amount of risk by discovering these defects and then not moving swiftly to plug up these holes. And you know, that risk really is best expressed in the ransomware epidemic. Ransomware was a kind of peripheral activity until the Vault 7, Vault 8 leaks, which saw the merger of some of these NSA, CIA cyber weapons with off-the-shelf ransomware. And that's when you got things like pipelines and hospitals and government agencies, whole cities being seized by petty criminals. It was quite kind of darkly funny when it started, because the people who were doing this, they weren't, you know, big state actors. They were just sort of random petty crooks who were willing to go about doing this. And these petty crooks, they would just ask for $300, just a blanket $300, whoever's computer they locked up. Mostly they were getting small firms, you know, an auto body shop or whatever, or, you know, someone whose family emails or their tax preparation materials or, you know, the photos of their baby were on their computer, who would cough up $300. And then they started catching hospitals, right, and locking up an entire, you know, $500 million medical facility. And they said, give us $300 or we're going to keep your hospital hostage. It was very weird. It was almost surreal, because like they just had no idea what they were doing. They were like, you know, normally we think of people who can seize an entire hospital in another country as being super criminals. And these guys were just idiots. And, you know, that's kind of more dangerous than super criminals with super weapons, because super criminals, they have some kind of rational calculus. They've got a goal. They're going to pick their targets. They're not going to just sort of strike indiscriminately. But these guys struck with absolute indiscriminate character, and they ended up getting a lot of dolphins in their tuna nets. So, you know, that's the kind of blowback that we've seen for mass surveillance. And it has created the spark of an anti-surveillance movement that is gaining steam, even if it hasn't come as far as you would hope, given the sacrifice that people like Ed Snowden made to bring mass surveillance into focus for so many of us. And I think that, you know, anything that can't go on forever will eventually stop. And mass surveillance is so toxic to our discourse, so dangerous and reckless, that I think that it can't go on forever. So the question isn't, will it end? The question is, how much danger and damage will result from it before we end it? And I like to think that these moments in which we seem to gain a lot of ground, even if we lost some of it afterwards, like the Snowden revelations, that these really did have these very positive effects that are hard to see, because the main positive effect is that when we finally do get rid of mass surveillance, it will come some time earlier than it would have if not for Snowden, and some unknown but large number of people will be spared the consequences of that mass surveillance as a result.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd like us to really go a bit closer to what big tech is, the companies that are in charge of this technology. How would you characterize the nature of big tech, Corey? I mean, are we talking about a few companies or individuals that have too much power, like Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, or is the problem that of their business models? The mass surveillance that you're talking about just right now, is that what's the problem? Or is it that big tech is operating within a much broader system that's problematic? In your opinion, where can we pinpoint the problem with big tech?
Well, I think the first thing we need to understand about big tech is they're not very good at innovation. You know, take Google. This is a company that made about three successful products. They made a very good search engine 30 years ago, and they made a pretty good Hotmail clone, and they made a kind of creepy browser. And then everything else that they've made in-house has failed, and every other success they've had, they got by buying another company. So Google Video failed, they bought YouTube, their ad tech stack, their mobile stack, their server management tools, their customer service tools, every part of Google's enterprise, with the exception of those three tools, they bought from someone else. Now, historically, we would have prohibited those kinds of acquisitions, and Google's not unique in having made them. Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, they're all company buying factories that pretend to be idea generating factories. Historically, antitrust regulators would have prevented these anti-competitive mergers and acquisitions and would have forced these companies to either figure out how to innovate on their own or get out of the way while people who had better ideas than them race past them, the way Google raced past Yahoo, the way Yahoo raced past AltaVista, the way AltaVista raced past the early tech companies like CompuServe and AOL. And instead, we've kind of frozen tech in time by allowing firms that have access to the capital markets to decide what the future of tech is going to look like. It's a planned economy, but it's one that's planned by a few very powerful financiers and the executives of a few large companies, not by a lawmaker or democratically accountable government, or indeed by an autocrat, or at least an autocrat in office. We get autocrats in boardrooms these days. And so once you understand that these firms' major advantage is in being able to access the capital markets and buy and extinguish potential rivals before they can grow to significance, then a lot more comes into focus. Then we start to understand where their power lies. You know, I think it's a mistake to believe the hype of Google and Facebook, who go out and tell potential advertisers, hey, you know, we've built a mind control ray that we can use to sell anything to anyone. And if you pay a premium to advertise on Google and Facebook, we will sell whatever you have. People have been claiming to have built mind control since Rasputin or before, and they were all lying. It may be the case that Google and Facebook have figured out how to build mind control, but I think, you know, these extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and the evidence is not extraordinary. The evidence is very thin. What we see instead is firms that have a monopoly. You know, Facebook can target 3 billion people because it spies on them all the time, and because it's basically impossible to use the internet without using Facebook. Even if you're not a Facebook user, every app you're using has a good chance of being built with Facebook's toolkit, which means that it's gathering data on you. Many of the web pages you land on are going to have some kind of Facebook integration. The same is true of Google and so on. So I don't think that it's the case that the surveillance business model is what gave these companies power. I think these companies' power let them adopt a surveillance business model that would otherwise have both been prohibited under any sane system of regulation, but also would have been undermined by competitors. You know, lots of people like having a great search engine, and lots of people like many things about that search engine. But one of the things that very few of us admire about Google or turn to Google because this is important to us is that Google spies on us. That's not why we're Google users. And historically, because of this universal nature of computers I alluded to when you asked your first question, historically, if you have a company whose products do three things that its customers like and one thing that its customers despise, if that's a digital product, someone will make an aftermarket mod that you can bolt on, that you can install, that gives you all the things you like and none of the things you don't. And what we've seen instead of those kinds of tools emerging is we've seen that whenever a company tries to build something like that, they're either bought out by Google or Facebook or Apple or one of the other big companies, or they're sued into oblivion for engaging into conduct that's very similar to the conduct that these firms themselves engaged in when they were growing. It's one thing for them to do it to us. It's another thing for us to do it to them. You know, when they do it, it's a legitimate progress. When we do it, it's theft. Every pirate wants to be an admiral. You know, the extent to which anti-hacking laws like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, copyright laws like Section 1201 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and its equivalents around the world, like the Article 6 of the European Copyright Directive, and other exotic laws, contract law, theories like tortious interference, non-compete law, non-disclosure, trade secrecy law, and so on, can be mobilized to prevent new firms and community groups and other actors from modifying these technologies so that they don't spy on us, but still deliver the parts that we like, talking to our friends, finding information in a speedy and convenient way. These companies are able to extend their rule to not fear being disciplined by regulation or by competition. And so, I think that the leaders of these companies would like us to think that they are one in a generation, one in a century, kind of genetic sports who are capable of feats that most of us can only dream of. And I think that the record really reflects that they're just ordinary mediocrities who have access to the capital markets and no discipline from regulators, who are able to buy their way to success and then use that success to get more capital to buy their way to continued success. And you know, that's the thing that has stopped, you know, other companies from doing unto Google what Google did unto Yahoo when it came along. And I don't think it's related to the business model. There is this idea that if you're not paying for the product, you're the product. Well, Apple has rolled out some really great anti-surveillance technology that blocks Facebook from spying on you. But it turns out that even if you turn on the Don't Spy on Me tools in your iOS device, your iPhone or your iPad or your iPod, Apple still spies on you. They deceptively gather almost an identical set of information to what Facebook would have gathered, and they use it to target ads to you, the exact same thing that Facebook uses. And the single biggest deal that Apple does every year that's negotiated in person between Apple's senior executive, Tim Cook, and Google's senior executive, Sundar Pichai, is the deal that makes Google the default search tool on iOS, which means that every time you use your iPhone, you're being spied on by Google. Nice. So Apple, you know, the idea that there is that there's a good company and a bad company, or that the surveillance business model turns, good, honest nerds into, you know, evil, crepuscular villains, I don't think it bears up to scrutiny. I think companies will treat you how they can get away with treating you. And if they can find a way to make money by treating you like the product, they will. And, you know, if you think giving them money will make them stop, you're a sucker.
I have to say, Corey, your response is the first one that's somewhat encouraging when you look at when you say they're just mediocrities that happened to get to have a monopoly. So essentially, if we're able to break their monopolies, then perhaps we're pushing back against this kind of collected power they've drawn to themselves.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I mean, you know, the problem with the mind control ray theory that, you know, you see advanced in books like Shoshana Zuboff's Surveillance Capitalism book is that it's kind of a council of despair. You know, there's a section in Zuboff where she says, well, what about competition law? What if we just broke these companies up and made them less powerful? She says, well, that won't make them less powerful, because now that they've got mind control rays, even if you make them small again, they'll still have the mind control thing. And rather than having one mind control ray out there being controlled by an evil supervillain, instead you'll get hundreds of evil supervillains. This is like suitcase nukes being wielded by, you know, dumb terrorists instead of coldly rational game theory playing leaders of superpowers. And, you know, like if we're going to have nuclear weapons, we want them just run by rational actors, not by every, you know, grudge bearing weirdo in the world. And I think that that would be true if they had in fact built super weapons. But I think that they haven't built super weapons. I think that they're dumb. I think that they're not good at their jobs. You know, they keep making their products worse. And they make lots of terrible blunders. But just like lots of powerful people, back to the theme of this report, lots of powerful people can fail up, where, you know, an error, if you've got very little margin for error, can be a death knell. If you've got a great big cushion, market power, capital reserves, access to the capital markets, powerful allies and government agencies and in other firms that depend on you for infrastructure and support, then you can make all kinds of blunders and kind of motor along. You know, you mentioned Elon Musk. He's the poster child for failing up. You know, a man who is so insulated by his wealth, his luck, and his privilege that it doesn't matter how many times he screws up, he can still land on his feet. Well, it militates for taking away his power and privilege, not for thinking that he is some kind of super genius who, no matter what we do to him, he'll always end up on top.
I have a follow-up to that, Corey, and I was wondering if, I mean, some people have criticized Zuboff for looking at the surveillance, but not really the issue of capitalism. And there's a sense that there are small companies out there. I can think of one. I work particularly in the area of borders, like Palantir, who are not one of the giants, but very much at this intersection of state and corporate power in a way that targets vulnerable refugees and migrants. So does she have a point in a sense that there is just breaking companies up is not going to end the kind of underlying business model of digital capitalism, that won't really be tackled without looking at the issues of the broader issues, not just the issues of size?
Oh, well, sure, except that you have to understand that the reason there's been so much inaction on all the other issues is size. You know, when I think back to the copyright wars, which is kind of where I started here, where you had a tech sector that in aggregate was probably an order of magnitude larger than the entertainment industry, maybe even two orders of magnitude at that point, larger than the entertainment industry. But it was composed of hundreds of firms, only a couple of them very large, and none of them dominant, right? You know, Microsoft was very big, but also fighting for its life and understood that at any moment it could be dethroned. Apple was rebounding from a near-death experience. IBM was busy getting out of the tech business and into the consulting business. And, you know, when you have a sector composed of hundreds of companies, one important factor about them is that their margins are going to be slimmer. You know, you mentioned Palantir. Palantir's founder, Peter Thiel, is famous for saying, "Competition is for losers." It is wasteful, right? Because it means that you have to cut your prices and treat your customers better. You know, for example, Facebook might have to hire more moderators if it had meaningful competition. You have to engage in expenditures to keep your customers happy that you could spend on other stuff. One of the other things you can spend your money on if you don't have to compete is lobbying. And when you have extra money to lobby, and you have a smaller number of entities that have to agree on what the lobbying message is going to be, you can make wonderful, terrible things happen in the halls of power for your sector. And that's what happened during the copyright wars. The relatively small entertainment industry was also extremely concentrated, and they had one message. It was completely in harmony. No one ever deviated from it by the smallest amount. And they showed up in the halls of power. They showed up in Congress and in the state houses, local governments, the United Nations, the European Union, and Westminster. They showed up and had an identical set of demands for each agency, each entity. Not one of them defected from message. They had absolute rigid discipline. And the reason they were able to do that is there was like seven of them. They could all agree. You know, they didn't have to like each other. They could all agree. When you have like 200 companies that represent a sector, much less 2,000, they can't even agree on how to cater their annual meeting, much less what they're going to tell lawmakers when they take meetings with them. And so the concentration in the tech sector that followed from the Napster wars, from the copyright wars, is what kept our privacy laws from advancing. It's when you have all that power rolled up into five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four, that they are able to effectively head off any privacy regulation, because they have lots of money to spend and they can all agree on how to spend it. And so this argument that we should attend to privacy but not competition misses the vital connection between our inaction on privacy and our forbearance for anti-competitive practices, the growth of corporate power that attended it.
Yes, I very much hear you there. I think size has very much shaped this discussion. I wanted to kind of do a bit of a broader look back to, I very much came of, I'm not sure what age you are, Corey, whether it's probably similar to mine, but I came in the 90s where it very much felt that the internet was very much an emancipatory tool. It felt like left and progressive forces were very much at the cutting edge of it, whether it was challenging structures like the World Trade Organization and some of the organizing that was going around from the time of the Zapatistas to the movements against unjust trade rules to the kind of overthrow of governments. But now we seem to be very much in a time where, like you say, the big corporations have got a choke point, a hold. And in terms of more broadly, in terms of the discourse, it's very much populated by disinformation, and where the right seems to be much more successful at mobilizing. So I was wondering what you feel has happened over these 20, 30 years, and what the lessons are, particularly for the left and progressive forces, from this apparent shift, if you agree that is a shift that has happened.
Yeah, I think that the flaw was not in seeing the liberatory potential of technology, and the blind spot was not in anticipating and fearing the potential of technology for confiscating liberty and power, but rather to fail to understand what had happened to competition law, and not just in tech, but in every area of law. That, you know, beginning with Ronald Reagan and accelerating through the tech age, remember that Reagan was elected the year the Apple II Plus hit the shelves. So the neoliberal economics in the tech sector cannot be disentangled. They're firmly interpenetrated. And, you know, the failure to understand that something really foundationally different was happening in how we allowed firms to conduct business, that we were going to just let them buy any competitor that got in their way, and that we would let the capital markets finance those acquisitions to create these monopolies, meant that the balance of forces that we had historically relied on, where for every company that wanted to take away something good from you, there was another company that wanted to give it to you, not because they were good-natured slobs, but because they thought you'd pay for it, that was dying, and that it was, you know, sick and reeling. You know, my own history, I'm about the same age as you, I'm guessing, based on that little account. You know, my dad was a computer science teacher at a high school, and we got an Apple II Plus for the summer in 1979, which, you know, I fell in love with and became a young technology-obsessed kid. I was 8 years old, and we got modems, and we were able to connect to the internet, and then, you know, not just the internet, but bulletin board systems and so on. The PC came along, and all of a sudden there were dozens of PC clones. The companies that were giant one day were collapsing the next, with some new company that was even more exciting coming up behind it. And it was easy to think that that was an intrinsic character of technology. And in retrospect, what I think it was the last days of a competitive marketplace for technology. It was the last gasp of technology. You know, the Apple II Plus was possible because of antitrust intervention in the semiconductor industry in the 70s. That was how we got personal computers. The modem was made possible by the breakup of AT&T in 1982. The IBM PC clones were only possible because of the 12-year antitrust fight against IBM, where eventually that fight was ended with IBM victorious, but it left IBM very scarred and traumatized and unwilling to engage in conduct that would invite new scrutiny. Among those was integrating making its parts proprietary, which is why I built the PC out of commodity parts, and why I didn't stop from companies from cloning its ROMs like Phoenix. And also that the DOJ had sued Microsoft or IBM rather, and tried to break them up for having integrated their software with their hardware, which is why they didn't sell their own operating system, why they got two kids named Bill Gates and Paul Allen to start a company called Microsoft to sell them an operating system, which they never bought out, which they allowed to operate as a separate entity. You know, later on, when Microsoft destroyed Netscape, the DOJ, you know, it's kind of its dying wheeze, intervened to try and stop Microsoft from doing it again. They eventually lost. Bush won, decided that he wouldn't pursue the case against them. But nevertheless, Microsoft was tamed by this. They didn't snuff out Google the way that they had Netscape. And indeed, you know, there's a really telling moment in 2019. Kara Swisher interviewed Bill Gates and said, why didn't Microsoft buy Android? And he said, oh, we were distracted by the antitrust action. Well, the antitrust action took place 8 years before Google bought Android. So he didn't mean he was distracted by the antitrust action. He meant that the antitrust action had tamed him, had made him unwilling to act in the ways that would provoke another antitrust action. Even he hadn't realized just yet how dead antitrust was, how much of a last gasp the antitrust action against Microsoft had been. And as a result, we now have this world where that foment, where that dynamism, where firms that might take your side, not because they were good, but because they wanted to seem good compared to whoever was dominant, we're always on the horizon. That era ended. And we live now in an ossified time, a time when tech, entertainment, and other sectors have merged, not just with each other, but with the military and the state. So that, you know, we have just an increasingly concentrated, dense ball of corporate power that is intermingled with state power in a way that is very hard to unwind.
So what would you say, Corey? Is the genie out of the bottle? I mean, can we at some point rein in the power of big tech? You've got like the General Data Protection Regulation in Europe, the Digital Markets Act. You're seeing some antitrust discussions in the US, and I think generally people are now awake to this power of big tech. How do you view these efforts at regulation, or do they have to be approached in a different way?
No, I think we're living through an extraordinary moment, regulatory moment on big tech and other kinds of corporate power that is long overdue and a long time coming. And I think that is down to a growing sense that big tech is not an isolated phenomenon, but is rather just one expression of the underlying phenomenon of increasingly concentrated corporate power in every sector. So that when we say we want big tech tamed, we are understood as participating in a movement that also says we want big agriculture tamed, and big oil, and big finance, and big logistics, and all of these other large integrated concentrated sectors that are increasingly dwindling to a half dozen companies or fewer, that provide worse and worse service, take larger and larger profits, inflict more and more harms, and face fewer and fewer consequences. And it's that cross-sectoral movement, that broad movement, that understands that tech, if it's exceptional, it's exceptional only in that narrow way of being a universal computer, but it's not exceptional in its corporate structure. It's not exceptional in the evil or the virtue of its corporate officers. And in fact, everything that we do to rein in big tech is a template for what we're going to do to rein in big telecoms, and, you know, the two companies that make all the beer, and the one company that makes all the cheerleading uniforms, and the one company that makes all the eyeglasses, and the two companies that make all the spirits, and the three companies that make all the music, and the five companies that publish all the books.
I just want to, just as a follow-up to that, what do you think is going to be need to kind of, if we're in this moment of where this is a lively debate, there's this awakeness and some signs of positive signs, what's needed to kind of push to make it a proper tipping point? What's needed at this point in your view?
So I think tipping point is maybe the wrong way to think about this. There's something in stats called the scalloped growth curve, You've probably seen these, right? Where you have a curve that goes up, hits a peak, goes down, but to a higher level than it was at before, and then comes up to a new peak and then to a higher level than it was before. So it's this kind of punctuated growth. And the way to think about that in terms of suspicion of corporate power is something bad happens. You know, last month, 1 million flyers on Southwest Airlines, which was part of the $85 billion airline bailout, and which has declared a $460 million dividend for its shareholders. 1 million people were stranded during Christmas week on their way to visit family or take vacations. And the secretary is supposed to be regulating them, Pete Buttigieg, who's well and fairly understood as a kind of corporate stooge. He did nothing. And he could have done. He had broad powers to intervene. He is at this moment one of the most powerful people in the history of the human race, right? The Secretary of Transit for the United States of America, circa 2023, has power that, you know, Caligula would have dreamed of having in terms of the way that he can project his will around the nation and the world. And he didn't act. And this has created lots of partisans for doing something about corporate power. Now, those people have other things to do with their lives. And a certain fraction of them, maybe even the majority of them, are going to say in a week or a month, or maybe a season, are going to say, I got to figure out what to do about this breast cancer or getting my kid through university or dealing with this layoff. This is not going to be top of mind for me anymore. But some of them won't. Some of them are going to nurse a grudge, and they're going to be part of this movement for taming corporate power. And because anything that can't go on forever will eventually stop, there will be another crisis in the future, and another and another and another, because these firms are so badly regulated, because they're so hollowed out, because they exercise power in such a parochial and venal way, and because they're run by such mediocre fools. They will eventually create more crises. And when that crisis happens, when the next crisis happens, when another 1 million people or 10 million people are harmed by corporate indifference or intransigence or greed, some of those people will join our movement too. And some of them will move on after a week or a month because something important comes up for them and they've got to move their focus. But some of them are going to bear a grudge, and it'll happen again and again and again. And I don't think it will be a tipping point so much as a kind of slow, inexorable build of popular will. And I think that our challenge is to get people to locate their criticism in the right place, to understand that it's unbridled corporate power and the officials who enable it, that it's not the special evil of tech or a highly improbable mind control ray. Or, you know, I'm sure this goes without saying, but it's not immigrants, it's not George Soros, it's not queers. It's unchecked corporate power. And if we can get people to locate their enemy in their crosshairs, the right enemy in their crosshairs, then the number of people who will be on the firing line will inexorably drive us towards a better world. Especially when coupled with the venality, the lack of self-control and executive function of our adversaries, who are incapable of getting their hands out of the cookie jar.
Sean, if it's okay, I want to just ask one other thing following up to that. And I've been enjoying your book, Choke Point Capitalism. And what I guess a lot of our conversation has been looking at the kind of users, consumers, activists. We haven't touched so much on workers. And so I'd love you firstly just to explain the idea of the choke point that these monopolies have, how they squeeze at both ends, as you talk about in your book. You have some good stories there about how kind of activists and workers have actually been part of these moments of confronting, limiting, or rolling back corporate and state digital power. So I was wondering if you could perhaps tell us one of the stories that inspires you that we could learn from moments.
I mean, my favorite one is actually Uber drivers, who we talk about as an exemplar in the book. So here in California, where I live, Uber was engaged in rampant wage theft of Uber drivers, not the normal wage theft of worker misclassification, but a separate form of wage theft where they were just keeping money that they owed, that they told the drivers they were going to give them, right? Not money that they illegally had not told them they were going to give them, but money they'd promised them that they were going to get. And In California, Uber drivers have to sign a binding arbitration waiver in order to drive for Uber. A binding arbitration means that you contractually agree that you will not bring any civil disputes in front of a judge. You waive all your right to sue. And instead, you agree that all of your disputes will be heard by an arbitrator. An arbitrator is a fake judge who works for a corporation employed by the company that wronged you, who then decides whether that company that's paying his salary should be held to account for their misdeeds. And you will not be surprised to learn that it's very rare for a corporate arbitrator to find against the company that signs his paycheck. But even if they do, it doesn't matter, because usually that settlement that you get is confidential. And even if you're allowed to talk about it, it's not precedential, which means that the next person can't come along and use the same argument that you use to get a similar outcome. And most importantly, a binding arbitration waiver means you can't join a class action, which meant that every Uber driver would have to individually hire counsel to represent them against Uber, which never possibly would have been economically sensible or feasible, which meant that Uber could get away with stealing all this money. And so the Uber drivers worked with a smart firm of lawyers, and they figured out how to automate arbitration claims. And the thing is that hiring an arbitrator, which Uber has to pay for as the entity that is imposing an arbitration waiver, hiring an arbitrator costs a couple $1,000s. And if 1 million people demand arbitration of their claims, if 1 million people file arbitration claims, then just rejecting those claims, just sitting them down in front of an arbitrator to say no, costs more than making them whole, costs more than doing the right thing. And in the end, Uber went in front of a judge and said, "Your Honor, these binding arbitration clauses that we put in these contracts, they're obviously unfair. How could they possibly be enforceable? Only an idiot would think that this was good contractual language and that could be upheld in court. We demand that you get rid of it." Now, this is, of course, a clause that they had previously sworn blind was completely reasonable and legitimate. And the judge knew it. And the judge, to his credit, made them go ahead with their binding arbitration. And so facing hundreds of millions of dollars in arbitrator fees, Uber settled with the drivers and gave them $150 million cash money, which is pretty goddamn amazing.
Oh, that's really cool. It's a sign that change is somewhat possible. To follow on that, I want to ask, do you think it's possible to reshape digital power, broadly defined as you described at the beginning, in the public interest, and to really use it to address the big crises? I'm talking the big global crises we're facing, such as environmental collapse. What models, policies, and systems do we need really to reshape it in the public interest? I know this is a broad question, but just your take on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that technology that's responsive to its users' needs, technology that is designed to maximize technological self-determination, is critical to any future in which we address our major crises. You know, the main thing that digital technology does, the best way of understanding its transformative power, is that it lowers transaction costs. Transaction costs are the costs that you bear when you try to do things with someone else. Anytime you try to do something with someone else, you have the potential to do something superhuman, something that two or more people are required for is by definition superhuman. It's more than one human can do. But anytime you organize with someone else to do something, as everyone who's ever done anything from planning a dinner out with friends to organizing a political movement knows, you also endure some inefficiencies. You have to agree. You have to have a meeting. You know, if you and I agree that we're going to knit a sweater together, we need to make sure that we're not both knitting the left sleeve, which means that at a certain point, we're going to have to get together and agree on who's going to knit what. And that meeting is time that we don't spend knitting. And so the time that we spend knitting, that's the transaction cost. That's the cost of trying to figure out how to get something done instead of doing the thing that we're figuring out. And the internet makes transaction costs so much lower. You know, it allows us to do things like build encyclopedias and operating systems and other big ambitious projects that historically would have taken big ambitious institutions with relatively small and modest institutions. And some things that used to require advanced planning can be done in a kind of easy improvisational way. You know, again, when I was a kid, if I wanted to go out to the movies with friends on a Friday night after school, we would either have to plan it in advance or we'd do this absurd thing where we would call each other's mothers from payphones. We'd put 25-cent pieces into payphones. And I'd say, you know, hey, if Zach calls, can you tell him Corey is downtown and thinking about going to see a movie, and tell him to leave a message with you about where I can meet him. And then I would call back an hour later to see if he'd called back and find out where I could meet him. And then maybe we would miss each other. And it was ridiculous. And of course, now you just send a text to your friend group, you know, to your group chat, and you say, anybody out for a movie? I'm downtown near the AMC 16. And before you know it, you're at a movie. So that's a simple and straightforward example of how we lower transaction costs. And lowering transaction costs is really important to fomenting social change, because by definition, powerful actors have figured out transaction costs. You know, if you're a dictator or a large corporation, you know, your job is to figure out how to coordinate lots of people to do one thing, the same thing at once. That is where the source of your power is, coordinating lots of people. It's not that you personally run around and get it all done. It's that lots of people act in concert to project your will around the world. And if you're one of the people that will is being projected upon, then by definition, you face high burdens from high transaction costs that your adversaries don't. And lowering transaction costs lowers them all around. You know, I talked earlier about how the cost of figuring out who is at a protest has never been lower for cops. But at the same time, the cost of organizing a protest has never been lower. You know, I spent a good fraction of my boyhood riding a bicycle around downtown Toronto, wheat pasting posters to telephone poles, trying to mobilize people for anti-nuclear proliferation demonstrations, anti-apartheid demonstrations, pro-abortion demonstrations, and so on. You know, anyone who's ever made fun of clicktivism, who hasn't been spent a night in the cold in Toronto riding around on a bicycle, wheat pasting posters to telephone poles, doesn't know what they're talking about. There is something amazing about clicktivism. It is riches beyond our wildest dreams of just a few decades ago, and a remarkable change in political organizing. And so I think our project needs to be not to snuff out technology, but to figure out how to seize the means of computation, to figure out how to build a technological substrate that is responsive to people, that enables us to coordinate to our will and our effort and our ethics to build a better future, to build a world that we want, including one with less carbon, including one with less injustice, more labor rights, and so on. Like, here's an example. We are often asked to choose between degrowth as a way of addressing the environmental crisis and material abundance. So we're told that degrowth means doing less with less. But there is a sense in which higher a degree of coordination would let us do significantly more with less. So, you know, I live in a suburban house outside of Los Angeles, and I have a drill. I have a drill because about six times a year, I got to make a hole in my wall. And because I only need to make a hole in my wall six times a year, I have the minimum viable drill. It's a genuinely terrible piece of technology. It is a miracle every time I use it, and it doesn't fly apart in a shower of white hot shrapnel. But it doesn't make any sense economically for me to own a better drill. Now, all of my neighbors also own terrible drills, because we all need to make between zero and six holes in our wall every year. And we all have a drawer for that drill. We all have some bits for that drill. The bits are also not very good. They're kind of made by, like, you know, out of spit and sawdust. They're the minimum viable drill bits. And there is such a thing as a very good drill. And if we had a world in which we weren't worried about surveillance because our states were accountable to us, and we weren't worried about coercive control, then we could have drills that were kind of statistically distributed through our neighborhoods, where there would be enough fantastic drills in your neighborhood, spectacular drills, that at any given moment, there would always be a drill for anyone who needed them. And the drills would tell you where they were. So you would just say to your neighborhood, hey, where is there a drill? And you would just go and get that drill. That is a world in which you have a better drill and are relieved of the burden of figuring out where to keep your terrible drill, where it's always available, always within arm's reach or a little further, but in which the material bill the energy bill, the labor bill for our drill drops by orders of magnitude. But it requires coordination and accountability in our technology.
Wow. Yeah.
So thank you so much, Corey. I don't know if you have any part in it.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation between myself, Sean Macheza, and Nick Buxton from TNI with Corey Doctorow, a prolific writer and a brilliant science fiction novelist, journalist, and technology activist. This interview is part of the 11th State of Power report, which focuses on digital power. Please be sure to check out all the other essays, as well as the infographics that give a good picture of digital power today. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from. And please write us a review, which will only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us today, and be sure to tune in next time.